Welcome to the Hobcast Book Show, a weekly podcast from Hobeck Books, an independent publisher of thrillers, crime, mystery, and suspense novels. Each week, we'll take you behind the scenes of what we do, the challenges and the triumphs, the bumps and troughs of running a creative business in this challenging world. We'll hear from the people who make this possible, the authors, the cover designers and editors, and we'll have expert insights from our guest star interviews. Nothing is off the agenda on the Hobcast Book Show from Hobeck Books, as we combine trad values and an indie spirit.
Hello!
And welcome to the Hobcast Book Show. It is episode number 105.
It is indeed.
And we are so pleased to have your company this week. The Hobcast Book Show is from Hobeck Books. My name is Adrian Hobart.
My name is Rebecca Collins.
Together we run the company which publishes the following four genres.
Thrillers.
Crime.
Suspense.
And mystery.
Perfect.
So delighted to have your company. It's going to be a busy week for us this week. Just to mention who our guest is, though, this week. David Beckler.
Yes.
Who is an author from the Manchester area, actually originally born in Ethiopia.
I know, he's had quite an interesting life, hasn't he?
Really
as
has.
We talk about in the interview.
Yeah, he's been a firefighter, he's been all sorts of things, but he is now also a successful author. So looking forward to speaking to David Beckler a little later in the programme. We say it's a busy week this week because we have our first book launch of 2023.
We do indeed, yes. Cut and Shut by Jonathan Peace.
Yeah, the third in his DC Louise Miller series, and it is fabulous. We're going back to Ossett in West Yorkshire, and we're going very dark.
We are.
In places.
And in fact, most of the reviewers have already said this is the best one yet. He seems to get better and better with each book, doesn't he?
Oh, absolutely. No question about it. It's absolutely gripping, but it's dark.
And we're looking forward to it.
Yeah, Cut and Shut by Jonathan Peace coming out the day after this podcast. So, yeah, the start of our first titles for 2023. Got lots of exciting ones to come.
Well, we do, because I think we mentioned last week that we've been reading some of the forthcoming books, and I have just finished reading book four by A.B. Morgan. I finished it in the bath. I loved it. I think it's her best one yet, and I can't wait to publish
it. Absolutely. We've got some, in the near future, we'll be announcing some great news as well.
Yes.
A returning favourite.
We can't say any more than that.
No, we can't.
We were dancing around the kitchen.
Yes, we were.
Which we do every day anyway, but...
Absolutely. Absolutely. Let's get into some publishing news. It's a little thin on the ground this week.
Yeah.
I think overall.
I mean, last week was full of the let's look ahead to 2023, let's look back on 2022. This week, there isn't very much at all. So it's a bit more lighthearted, most of the news. But I thought this would interest you.
Uh-huh.
Considering you went to see some snooker last week.
I did.
Seven Dials are going to be publishing a memoir by Ronnie O'Sullivan, who I'd never heard of last week, but now I have heard of him, called Unbreakable.
Oh, I see what they've done there. That's clever, that. Yeah, they've done Unbreakable because it's like...
Is that what he sounds like?
Yeah, he does sound a bit like that. Yeah, he does. It's like a slightly higher-pitched Michael Caine.
He's been going 3 decades, it says here.
He's amazing. Well, he started off in 1992. In fact, our three players known as the class of 1992 who have won multiple world titles between them, those being Mark Williams, John Higgins, and Rocket Ronnie O'Sullivan, who is without question the greatest player ever.
Is John Higgins related to Alex Higgins?
No.
Oh, it's just coincidence.
He's Scottish. No. Rocket Ronnie is... I had the good fortune of watching him live the other day. He lost, but against Mark Williams, funnily enough.
Yeah.
But it was unbelievable snooker. And he is a true showman in the way he plays. I mean, he plays left-handed when he feels like it.
Yeah, I love that. Being a bit sort of either or myself, you know.
Yeah, and he has he's very colourful background. His dad was involved in... shall we say, the more exotic elements of the Soho nightlife.
You mean like ladies?
Well, I mean, you know, Ronnie O'Sullivan grew up in, you know, playing snooker in snooker clubs in Soho where his dad was, well, his dad has spent a lot of time in jail. Let's put it that way.
Oh, okay.
Right, so...
Is he a bit of a gangster?
I wouldn't wish to allege that,
but that might be one way of interpreting okay. it. But the fact is that Ronnie's early career had this background of his dad being in jail the whole time. He's such a compelling figure because, you know, one minute he's absolutely brilliant, the next minute he's terrible, and he's always threatening to retire. And then the next time you see him, he's winning the world title again.
A bit like Andy Murray, who we've been watching.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he's been absolutely brilliant this week.
Oh, there was that one match against Krakenakis.
Yeah, Tanasi Krakenakis of Australia.
Oh, we were gripped, weren't we? Oh, all
yeah,
of us.
Yeah, yeah, no, absolutely. He's played amazing, amazing tennis on his metal hip. It's been brilliant. But anyway, that'll be a good book.
Yes.
That will sell a lot.
It comes out a month before your birthday.
Does it? That's yes. quite early. So they're hoping, I presume, because the World Championships are held towards the end of April, that he'll have won a world title and it'll promote book sales in May.
Yes, yeah, 11th of May it comes out. Yeah. So
okay, we'll that's what they're timing that. It for then, lots of BBC TV coverage. But he's not playing that well at the moment, that has to be said. So, yeah, that's good. Now, the other memoir that everyone's talking about...
I was going to say, I would like Ronnie O'Sullivan's memoir to smash the record, which was achieved by Prince Harry's memoir this
Spare.
Week.
Spare, yes.
So he smashed a record, which was the fastest-selling non-fiction book since the beginning of Nielsen BookScan records. He sold, you'll find mm-hmm. it's hard to believe, I think, and not one copy in this house, I have to say, 467,183 print copies, very precise, in the first week.
Yeah, yeah. And 670,000 in the United
States. I know.
So it's already made its money back, even though they paid him £20 million for the privilege. However, I would dispute, having read a very long article this morning about just how much of it is inaccurate, that you could call it non-fiction. Because there are enormous chunks of the book which do not stand up to any sort of scrutiny. And people who are described in the book coming out and saying, it never happened that way, he's making it up. And actually, there's huge errors of timing and all sorts of things, and locations. And, Prince Harry will hide behind the fact he said, oh, it's my ghostwriter who put all this stuff in.
Well, yes, but he's quite a well-known ghostwriter.
He's the world's number one ghostwriter
person.
Who got paid £1 million to do the book. But it is, it's pretty shocking. I mean, there are just legions of these inaccuracies, misinterpretations, exaggerations within the book.
So
really, really quite dramatic ones.
I went into
months out of date. And
oh, really?
Stuff like that, yeah.
Oh, gosh. So I went into Waterstones yesterday in Shrewsbury, and there was a huge pile as soon as you walk in the door of Harry's face, all half price. I was tempted for a second or two.
What, to throw rotten tomatoes at it? I'm straying into Jeremy Clarkson territory there.
A little.
Well, look, it's going to dominate for a long time, but I don't think we need to give Spare any more of our time.
No more Spare time.
No, indeed. And our final story.
Well, this is quite a nice story, I think, and I think we should try this at Hobet Books. I don't know in which book, but Kate Bush has just sold her paperback rights for her How to Be Invisible, which is a compendium of selected lyrics. And apparently some of the copies will have messages written in invisible ink.
Do you think she'll write things like, whoa, 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 in invisible ink?
Yes, exactly that.
You know, because those wonderful lyrics of hers.
She's a legend, isn't
I know
she?
She's a, I know, I know.
I'm very fond
but
of Kate
But if you think
Bush.
About it, there's quite a lot of sort of noises as well as lyrics. Well, that's within her performances.
Yes, but I think that's what makes her a legend. She was able to make noises.
She is a fascinating person, and I mean, her success came so early. She was spotted by I'm going to mention Mick Floyd again. David Gilmour of Pink Floyd spotted her talent, recommended her to his record company or their record company, EMI, and she was only in her teens when she was first discovered. And then, of course, you know, she had all that success and then sort of basically disappeared in her mid-20s, maybe, you know, late 20s, and didn't resurface for another 20 years with any more work, which is extraordinary.
But when I picture Kate Bush, I always picture in that sort of fuzzy vision with dark eye makeup and fuzzy hair.
Yeah.
Does she still look like that?
No, I don't think so. But, I mean, that's the thing. She's a recluse. She did some performances at the Hammersmith Apollo, a few performances there recently, not so recent. Well, I mean, a couple of years ago or so. But it's, you know, she really is very, very reclusive. So interesting character. Well, that will be, you know, if you can get one with the invisible ink. The trouble is, how much invisible ink revealer will people be scrabbling onto their pages to see if they got a you know, one of the messages?
Well, you would, wouldn't you? Because you would want to be the one, or one of the ones. And also, how does the printer do that? Because they're printed, you know, something like clays, probably. Do they have invisible ink?
Well, we better ask them, because I think we need to have an edition of our books with it in.
We do.
We do indeed. Okay, let's get to our interview. We spoke to David Beckler, who is a former firefighter, which always fascinates me. Anyone who's been in that sort of public service. Now, he's retired from the service some years ago and has gone through many jobs, but is now a fabulous crime writer.
He is, yes. He's a businessman. He does all sorts.
Oh, yeah, as he'll reveal.
And sunglasses.
Yeah, and supplier of PPE to the NHS at one stage. It's all sorts of things that he's been... But his background, he was born in Ethiopia, grew up there for the first 8 years of his life.
Yeah.
And then moved to the UK and has had a life in service, really, for the public. And it's that experience of working alongside, you know, your colleagues in very, very difficult circumstances that inspires quite a lot of his work. His two main characters in his novels are former Royal Marines. And that camaraderie is at the core of the stories. But let David himself explain how he got to that point. David Beckler. Thank you so much for joining us, David Beckler, from your home in Manchester. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on. I'm really looking forward to having a good chat with you too.
Fantastic.
That's what everybody says.
Yeah, well, they do until they get to the random question, but we'll wait a good time for that. You've got plenty of time to worry about it. Let's get to it then with your career, and let's go to the origins of when you started writing. I mean, what inspired you? Because you've had a very active career. You've been a firefighter. At what stage of your life did you decide that writing was for you too?
I was about 50, and it was more of a bit of a challenge from my partner, because I'd read a book and I just said to her, I'm sure I can write something like this. And she said, well, go on then. So I just started writing evenings after work when I had a bit of spare time. It took me about 18 months to finish the first novel, which still hasn't been published.
It's
in the drawer, does it?
A lot of people say that. They say they wrote a novel, but they haven't. They've put it in the drawer and then moved on to other things and never done anything with the very first one.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, I'm quite stubborn, so I'm determined to publish it, but it just needs so much work. And it's going to be book five of my first series. It will come out eventually. I've just got to write books three and four.
Right, so that's your first series is the Mason and Sterling series.
That's correct, yeah. Adam Sterling's a firefighter, so I didn't have to do a huge amount of research to get his character right. And that's been, I started that, that was the first series I wrote, and the first two novels have been published. They've been out a few years now, but I've then moved on to a more political thriller.
And those are the Antonia Conti series?
That's right, yeah.
Right, which are currently published by Thomas and Mercer, aka Amazon, which is fantastic to be picked up by them.
Yeah. Because
they can do amazing things for an author career.
They can, yeah. And I'm a member of the Crime Writers Association, and we obviously chat about our publishers and how we're getting on. And most authors have got gripes about their publishers, but the one I heard the fewest gripes about was Thomas and Mercer, which surprised me really, because as a big company, Amazon's got a reputation for being difficult to deal with. But as the publishers, they've been fantastic, really. I'm not just saying it because I'm with them now, but everything they've done has been excellent. You know, I've got no complaints. The editing's been a dream, really. And the only areas where they're quite prescriptive is the titles and the covers. And that's obviously, title and cover is a big marketing thing, and that's their expertise. So I'm happy for them to do that, as long as the words inside the covers are mine, and they are. So that's great.
Fantastic. Mm-hmm. So that journey into writing, I mean, you've got your first novel sat in the drawer. At some point, it'll become published. How difficult was it that first
foray into writing? Because I mean, 18 months is pretty quick, actually, for the first novel, I would say.
Some people say like 10 years.
Do they? All right. Well, once I get into a book, I can write fairly quickly. And the first one that was published, I finished the first draft in about 5 weeks. But at the time, I was running a sunglasses business, and at times of the year, it's fairly quiet. So I was basically writing full time when I did that. It was in a lull between the summer and the delivery of next season sunglasses, you know. So yeah, I mean, I can write fairly quickly when I need to. And in fact, Amazon only gave me 3 months to write book three in this series, and that was to not just the first draft. I had to produce quite a reasonably polished manuscript. So yeah,
is that while working full time as well?
Yeah, actually, I started a new business after lockdown. My sunglasses business just dried up because I was supplying supermarkets and department stores. And obviously, when they shut, they just stopped selling stuff. And I could see issues with getting containers and delivery costs and dealing with China, which is where most sunglasses are made. So I looked for something else. So I just started a new business, and it was just taking off at the same time. So I didn't get a lot of sleep, but it was worth it.
Wow.
And you managed to meet the deadline.
I did, yeah.
Well done.
That's quite tight. We're not that demanding, are we?
No.
Nothing like.
No, yeah. I think I'm too soft sometimes, because when one of our authors says, oh, I need a bit more time, I say, that's fine. Take your time.
Yeah, I'm sure I'd have got more time if I needed it, but I work a lot better towards deadlines. You know, when I've got months ahead of me, I sort of I amble along and think, oh, I'll just check social media for a bit, and then I'll make a sandwich and a cup of tea. And whereas if I've got a deadline,
What the audience need to know is that Rebecca has started pointing at me for some reason, and I have absolutely no idea why.
No, you don't, do you?
No.
Because you're too busy checking social media and making a coffee.
Let's talk about the two series then. I mean, the original series and the dynamic between your characters, because they're both ex-Royal Marines, and that's something that always pricks my ears up, because, as Rebecca will tell you, I will watch anything involving the Royal Marines repeatedly. And the most impressive of all of the documentaries I've ever watched about them was the one where, I don't know if you've seen it, Chris Terrell, who is a filmmaker, aged 55, became the oldest man to pass all four commando tests while making a film about the Royal Marines, which is extraordinary to push himself to the limit. And he's the man who's making, for British viewers, the new series about HMS Queen Elizabeth, which comes out next week. But anyway, I digress. But I find them absolutely fascinating as an organisation, as a unit. Have you spent any time with the Royal Marines in research?
No, I haven't. My best mate was in the Royal Marines for 9 years, so I used to get a lot of information from him. And the fire service training is based on, I mean, obviously we don't shoot anybody, but it's based on the basic training is based on Royal Marines training.
Wow, I never knew that. That's extraordinary, because the level of fitness.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, if being a firefighter,
you have to be, but
the level of fitness that they're driven to is so you're being trained along the same lines then.
Yeah, you are. Yeah. It's something I don't think is as intense. And on my course, there were 5 instructors and 2 were ex-Royal Marines. So they gave us an insight on what would be required, and they let us know that what we were doing was nowhere near as tough as it was on the same principles, you know, so you get an idea of how it works, and the camaraderie is the same, you know, you're relying on, obviously when I left the fire service in 2001, and through most of my career it was always just by men, so all the crews I worked with were all male. So it's a very similar sort of dynamic, team dynamic. You know, you're relying on other people, they're relying on you. You don't want to let each other down. And when you go through some difficult times, it does give you a strong bond there.
Absolutely. And it's an interesting dynamic around those public services at the moment. I mean, clearly there are lots of problems in terms of funding and pay and all those sort of things, which are reflecting in the strikes that have been happening, and, you know, quite understandably. But in terms of the way that culture of such organizations has changed, it's been quite dramatic in the sense that, as you say, it's no longer necessarily all male squads of firefighters working at particular stations. And also, there is a lot more awareness now, I think, than there was then, of the mental health impacts of the things that you do and the risks that you've taken and the things that you no doubt have witnessed. So does that reflect in your work in terms of the way that your characters are behaving in the books, or is it or is it sort of set further back in a time that you remember?
The latest I've got to is 2002, so it's roughly the time when I was working. So the procedures are the same as they were when I was working. Things have changed quite a lot, and obviously in Greater Manchester, which is where I last served, the number of firefighters has dropped from something like 2,200 to 1,300. So there's big changes. And where I last worked, we had a crew of 16, and now there's 7.
Wow. 7? Gosh.
So we used to have 2 fire engines and a hydraulic platform, which is an access vehicle, which used to go up to about 95 feet. And now they've just got the 1 fire engine.
Blimey.
For the same area. Yeah. So the job's changed a lot. Yeah.
Yeah, it is. I mean, something that's always fascinated me, because I mean, I was a journalist in Brighton, and obviously a lot of the day-to-day stuff I'd be paged, carried a pager in those days, the mobile would be rubbish, phone the office, and they'd send me out to whatever overnight fire somewhere in the Sussex area, and you got to see. But also, of course, the other thing that firefighters do, which is probably a more regular shout.
What, rescue kittens from trees?
No. Oh. I mean, talking about road traffic accidents and the cutting gear that you have. Again, something that is, actually probably in some ways starker than some of the fires that you would attend. I mean, it has always fascinated me, the sort of mentality and the incredible professionalism. When I used to go on a shout out to, whatever fire, and then the commander would be so erudite and clear about what they were doing, and it was just extraordinary how organized and impressively professional everything was.
But they have to be, don't they?
Well, yeah, but I'm just trying to say that it is amazing to witness.
Mm. Yeah, I think most fire services do a good job of training their staff. I mean, one of the things is by the time you finish your recruits course, you know enough to not be a danger to your colleagues, but then you learn the proper stuff when you're on a station, and you're taught by your colleagues and the junior officers. And in most cases, they do a good job. They do a really good job. Yeah,
it's fascinating. The other thing I was going to say about that side of things is, I remember being sent probably the first thing I ever got sent out professionally to go and report on was at Castle Combe Motor Racing Circuit near Swindon.
Right.
Where they were, now I'm trying to remember which fire truck company it was, but they were showing off a new vehicle that could handle taking speed bumps. And not rolling too badly. And the other thing it could do was take corners better. So right. This thing was actually going round the circuit over speed bumps at some ridiculous speed, trying to sell itself into, it was a Dennis. Yeah, of course it would be. These things you take for granted, but when you learn about the technology that's involved and the thoughts that go into trying to cope with the conditions that you guys face, there's a lot of effort goes into that.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, and the development of new machines is a key area now, because they're looking at reducing crewing, and technology is having to take the strain. Yeah, funnily enough, actually, I mean, Swindon was my first posting. I joined
Wiltshire.
Yeah, before I moved up to Manchester. Three years in Wiltshire, and 16 years in Manchester.
Yeah, what's the contrast like between you know, largely rural area like Wiltshire and Greater Manchester?
Well, when I went to Manchester, they sent me to Moss Side, and Moss Side did more fire calls than the whole of Wiltshire.
That well, I can believe. Moss Side has a certain reputation for those who don't know it.
It was quite a rude awakening, yeah.
And I've got to ask, I mean, that thing about, you know, because I used to attend shouts in bits of Brighton that were a bit rougher than perhaps others, and that actually quite a lot of the effort had to be to protect the equipment from interference from the locals. Well, is that the case in Moss Side? Well, no, I mean, yeah, to vandalise, or, you know, even on one occasion I went to a shout, which was at the Lewis Bonfire Festival, and the fire brigade obviously were Sussex fire brigade were deployed because anything can happen, given that there are 3-year-olds carrying flaming torches like something out of a 16th century horror movie, and it and anything can happen. The fireworks being let off willy-nilly in the street, but they had to have a cordon of police around the vehicles to protect them from being vandalized. I found it extraordinary.
Yeah, I mean, it does happen. Moss Side wasn't too bad, actually. There's quite a good community spirit, and I joined Moss Side just after the riot, so there's still a bit of unrest, but there was a lot of good will towards the fire service. The biggest problem we encountered was after the Strangeways riot, and because there were rumours that the fire service were involved in getting the guys off the roof, and we were, but obviously these rumours take hold, and we used to get attacked quite often. In fact, one of the crews I was with got shot at.
Really? Gosh.
Yeah. So, yeah, it can be a bit hairy, but we always had lockable lockers.
Right.
Just in case.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. So, given that experience, being in that close knit team, how much does that drive the thrust of the relationships within those books?
Well, in the Sterling Mason series, it was it's key. I mean, the relationship between Adam and Byron is what drives the whole series, and their willingness to do anything, really, to help each other out. That's the key to how the stories work.
Yeah, and in terms of that dynamic over the series, I mean, has it broken down, that relationship, at any time under strain, or has that always been that solid bond between them?
I'm not going to give away the...
But I think what you're saying, though, is that essentially it's the relationship between the characters, which is an important driving force in the book.
Yeah. It is, yeah. And it comes under strain, yeah, definitely. But
just like any relationship.
Yeah, it does. But... So far, no, they're not broken down yet. Yeah, and actually, they appear in my second series.
Oh, right,
that's good. I like it when things like that happen.
In book two, which is coming out on Thursday this week, Adam has quite an important minor role in that, and Byron appears a bit more in the background.
So was that a deliberate choice? Did you think, oh, I want to bring them in, or did that just...
Well, I needed a firefighter because my main character, Antonio, was involved in a car crash, and he's in charge of the crew that rescues her. So he's 20 years older than in the other books, so he's nearing retirement.
A gnarled veteran by this point, yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So we're talking about the release of A Stolen Memory then, which comes out on Thursday, second of your Antonia Conti.
So that'll be out by the time this podcast goes out. It'll be published.
Yeah.
Yes, it will, yeah.
How excited do you get now for a book release, given you've had a few out? Does it still fill you with excitement or fear, or what?
Do you still open the champagne?
it's a combination. Yeah, you celebrate, obviously, because it's great to get your book out there. You also feel a bit apprehensive, whether people will like it as much as they like the last one, or as much as they didn't like the last one. It's a combination, and also the feeling, well, maybe this is where I get found out. People realize
imposter syndrome. Yeah, that's everybody has that, don't they? They always have this worry. However many books you've written or however experienced you are, or even if you've had mostly 5-star reviews, you still have that sort of niggling, I'm not worthy feeling.
Yeah, I mean, you just think, well, maybe it's people are just being nice. You know, maybe my publisher was being nice when she said she really liked it. But you know that it wouldn't be published if it was rubbish. You know, so
yeah,
no,
and it's very normal to have that. And I think it would be strange if you just thought, no, I'm fantastic.
Well, I think you find that the people who get to that stage sort of start to go downhill. Then, you know, I think you need self-doubt to keep you sharp and make sure that you're putting your best effort into every book.
Absolutely.
And also, you if you continually want to improve as well, so you always see there's room for improvement, and then you will, because you see that. And
yeah, of course, yeah. I mean, whenever I read my earlier books, not that I go around reading them, but I was converting one into a screenplay, and I was reading it and I was thinking, oh, God, I wish I could change this, I wish I could change that. You know, so it is a case of continual improvement, I think. You know, and you look at some of the big authors like Manat, Ian Rankin, he didn't really get into his stride with Drebus until like book 7, you know.
Yes.
It takes a while to, and especially when you've got a serious character or characters, they evolve and you discover more things about them, which is to a non-writer just seems strange that you've actually made that person up, but you're still discovering things about them, because you can't just say this is what the character will do. As you write them, you find out that doesn't seem right, you know, that actor wouldn't behave that way because of other things they've done in the past. So to me that's a nice problem to have when I'm trying to write a scene and I think, actually, that doesn't feel right because of other stuff that character's done. But it does tell you that you've actually got a proper real person rather than a cipher.
Yeah, they're so not a character, are they? They could be a real person because they can make their own decisions based on their experiences and their personality, which you've created. But the more developed they are, they have more agency in a way. I mean, this sounds a bit odd, doesn't it? I
know, but it's what Anne Coates was saying last week about the golden thread, the, you know, this extraordinary thing that happens when you're writing, where a character will actually pull you up and say, ain't going to happen that way. it just doesn't fit. You know, I would do this, not that.
Yeah. Definitely, yeah. I mean, it is a bit of a problem, because then you've got to try and replot it, but it's a nice problem. You know,
it is.
I like that, though, that you had a plan and then your character saying, no, I wouldn't do that. So you think, let's start again.
Yeah, hopefully come up with a better one. Yeah.
Absolutely. And let's just focus on the theme of and the plot sort of device of your latest book. So in A Stolen Memory, you've got a sort of mysterious company, GRM, who are, it's set in the near future. They've introduced a program to alter prisoners' memories, removing those that led to their criminal behavior. And Antonia Conti, we've been talking about, is a journalist, and she decides to investigate, and it sort of cascades into, yeah, people trying to stop her from finding out the truth. Which is, you know, we've funnily enough, we were working with an author on something not dissimilar, in fact, in terms of how technology can be implanted. And, this is a near, it's not happening yet, but people are working towards it. And this is obviously a lot more, perhaps, a darker purpose behind that use of technology. So when you came up, when did you come up with that idea, and what inspired it?
Quite a long time ago, actually. I mean, I wrote the first Antonia Conti book in 2014, and it was sort of dystopian, set in the future. But by the time I was writing book 3, I was having to ramp up the corruption and the dystopia to match what's already happened. The memory thing, yeah, I mean, it's something I've always been interested in. And about sort of 5 years ago, I was outlining books two, three, and four for the series. And I thought that was one because Antonia is haunted by her memories, and it's a Achilles' heel really. In book one, she's put under a lot of physical stress, and we discover how tough she is. But in book two, she's being attacked through her Achilles' heel, and she has a much harder time. So I thought it'd be a good way to show her vulnerability.
People do like that, don't they? When a character, although they are a very strong character and have been through some quite difficult situations, but then, you know, having that sort of vulnerability where they have to fight even more than normal, and then they're rooting for them. The readers are rooting for them.
Yeah, I mean, I think obviously everyone's vulnerable in some way or other, and it's and obviously their enemies are trying to identify that, and they themselves need to be aware of where they're weak so that they can be buttressed against any attacks. But in a lot of the three novels cover corruption, which is something that I'm pretty keen that we become more aware of, and we have done obviously over the last couple of years because it's become much more open. But when I wrote the first novel, corruption wasn't considered to be a huge problem in this country because it was you don't get policemen stopping you for speeding and then taking a 50 quid note to let you off, and you don't get minor officials asking for money so that they can expedite your application for something, and the corruption we've had in this country has always been at the top level, and it's been much less when we did have the brown envelopes at the Ritz in the late 80s, early 90s, but it's a lot more sort of back scratching and nodding a wink and I'll do you a favor if you do me a favor, but it's still corruption.
Absolutely.
No, totally. And what amuses me is we just watch it as if we're watching TV and let them get away with it.
to an extent, yeah.
It does appear that way, doesn't it?
But I think it's an interesting thing that, you were sort of, as an author, a bit of a canary in the coal mine, your people have said to you, this is too far-fetched, it never happens. But actually, you've been proven right.
Mm.
And you're aware of what goes on. And is that side of your writing, that in a sense, you're writing a thriller, it's an adventure, you want people to be turning the page, racing onto the next chapter and all of that, but does that political point or the sort of moral point you're making within those books, is that one of the driving forces behind what you write?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is in every crime novel, isn't it? Most crime novels address a moral point, and the story really is the characters. To me, that's the most important part of any book I'm reading. If the characters are great and I'm really enjoying being with them, it might not be brilliantly plotted, but you're there with the characters. Yes. I focus on the characters first, and then the plot and the action, and then the political and moral view is reflected in the actions of the characters. The characters are the moral drivers, and they behave in the way they do because of the moral imperative that they feel. And if they didn't feel that, then it would be an artificial construct.
Yeah. I know what you mean. Yeah. So it almost makes it more authentic because it comes from the characters themselves, as opposed to you as an author imposing a political message. But the characters are driving it.
Yeah, I mean, when you say political message, it's political with a small p, really.
Yeah.
To me, I mean, politics is everyday life. Everything is political. Whether people are starving on the streets or people have got, the right to protest, things like that. And to me, the important thing is that the characters believe what they believe rather than you're trying to get them to do stuff, which is what we were saying before about a character will behave in a way that you hadn't intended. and it might show a weakness in their personality or a strength in their personality that you weren't aware of, which will add to the depth of the story.
Absolutely. I wanted to ask you about, over the arc of your career, in the sense of going back to the craft, where would you say that you feel, you were talking about, I sometimes go back to my old books or whatever. Where do you think you've improved most as a writer, do you think?
I think I've improved the most in probably trying to create tension and excitement without having too much action. I think in my there's a lot of action in my books, but I can sort of ramp up the tension now just by hinting at something that's happening rather than making it happen.
Yes.
I think that's a very important point, isn't it? Because sometimes it's often about the implications of things, or what you're not saying can say just as much as what you are saying.
Yeah. I mean, I think it was Hitchcock who said that if you have a bomb under a table and it goes off, you've got 10 seconds of action. But if you've got a bomb under a table and the two characters don't know that it's there, but the audience does, you've got 20 minutes of tension.
Yeah,
good. I like that.
It's like it's the old trope of, you introduce a gun at some point in the foot in an opening scene or something. You've got to make sure there's a payoff with that gun towards the end of the book or whatever, because otherwise,
or the scene. I think it was Chekhov, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yeah, you're quite right. So that's fascinating, and I noticed that you were a guest on a panel with N.W. Craven recently at Capital Crime. I mean, in terms of your author profile do you do many of those sort of events? Was that a new?
That was my first one, actually, and it was
first of many, hopefully.
Yeah, it was the day before my Antonio Conte book was published. So it was I was on it with him and Sean Cosby as well, who is a fantastic author, really. I mean, it couldn't have been a more high profile panel for me as a newbie. I'm sure people are saying, we know those two, who's that guy?
Not at all.
But it was a great experience, really enjoyed it. I did one at Newcastle Noir. That was really good. We had a really good laugh. That was about dystopian fiction. But I didn't realise it could be so much fun.
It's a lot. I mean, we go to lots of festivals, the whole time, don't we?
Yeah. I'm planning to go to the Big Four in the UK, which is Crime Fest in Bristol, Harrogate, Bloody Scotland, and then back to Capital Crime.
Yeah.
Well, we might get to meet you then, because we
will certainly be sending at least two or three of those, I should think.
Harrogate and Crime Fest.
Yeah, we'll keep in touch and we'll meet up.
We'd love to. No, it's terrific. So, it's so exciting to speak to an author in the week they're being published.
Yeah, and also,
it really is. And so, going forwards, what's
next?
I mean, clearly there's an appetite. Thomas and Mercer want book three, and you're working towards that. Have you got any other series in your mind, or is it strengthening the two existing ones?
Well, I've got a fourth book in the Antonio Conte series, which is being outlined, and I've got ideas for book five, but obviously I've not been signed up for those yet. I'm working on my next Mason and Sterling book, which, as I mentioned before, book five is already written. But
so not in the drawer.
I'm working on book three, and that's partly set in the south of France, so I'm going to have to do a bit of a research trip.
Hardship.
I know. But you've got to do it to get the authenticity. And I'm working on another one set in Manchester, which hopefully I'll get that finished by probably April.
Fantastic.
Wow, you're very busy.
Well, it's been great. I mean, let's put you under real stress, though. I mean, I know you've faced many stressful situations in your previous roles, but this could tip you. This is the point where we go to the random question. So I'm going to do the voice, and then Rebecca will hit you with the toughest question in British podcasting. Here we go. Rebecca's random question.
Okay, so we've established you live in Manchester, and that's related to the question.
Okay.
I'm going to give you a choice of two alternate careers that you could have pursued. One is rock guitar star, and the other is player for Manchester United. What would you choose and why?
I would choose to be a footballer, yeah. I'm not a big fan of football. And obviously in Manchester, you have to know how the two teams are doing. So this week it's United's on the up.
He's a United fan.
Right, a professional sportsman. I was a keen rugby player. And it would have been, to be able to play professionally would have been quite a
big... Okay, so would it have been, okay, here's the choice then. Would it be Salford Reds or Sale Sharks?
What's that?
Or it's Union or League.
It would be Union. Yeah. I mean, I learned my rugby down in the West Country, so in Bristol.
Ah.
So yeah, we didn't have league down there.
No, absolutely not.
We had a league as well, but.
Well, it's funny you say that, because I did actually play rugby. My only game of rugby league was playing for Exeter University, so down in the southwest, and we got. And unfortunately, it was against Loughborough. Our number one, and we were rubbish. I mean, we were
against Loughborough. Yeah, anyone would be.
I mean, I was not a fit student, and I was—I don't know—I was just making up my numbers. It was a disaster. I was actually there to report on it, and this the funny thing is that they were down on numbers. They could only field 12, so I had to put the kit on and go and represent my university, which is the only time I was ever invited to do any sport for Exeter. But sorry.
Well done for surviving.
Well, God, I mean, yeah, there wasn't much left of me at the end of it.
But you're still here.
But I did enjoy the sensation in rugby league of having been tackled, trying to get the ball away to my, to the guys and the rest of the team.
Mm.
But I didn't touch the ball a lot, has to be said. It was more sort of flailing as someone charged past me from Loughborough. But no, that's an interesting thing. So, yeah, Sale Sharks.
So what would you pick? Rockstar or...
We were thinking about this last night.
I did actually ask him the question last night, but I said tennis ace or rockstar.
Yeah, too. Because I'm passionate about tennis. But I think rockstar, because the aches and pains of, of tennis. 4.5 hours in a 5-set Grand Slam match. There wouldn't be much left of me, I don't think. You know, bad enough if I've had 20 minutes on the court.
If you're a professional tennis player, you'd be able to cope, wouldn't you?
Well, you'd think so. But then look, Andy Murray had to have two new hips. I mean, it takes its toll. I think the rock star thing.
Yeah, you're more of a rock star than a tennis star.
Yeah, there we go. What about you, love?
I think rock star too. I quite like the idea of being on stage and with my guitar. And
it's a funny thing. You know, we're both quite introverted, and yet... put us on a stage, we love it.
Yeah, I
it's
do.
It's just weird.
Yeah.
Put me in a room full of people and tell me to mingle. No, thanks. That's scary.
You just want the spotlight on you and nobody else.
Yeah, then a bit of that. Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Well, I mean, they do say quite a lot of big name actors are introverts.
Yes.
They like the spotlight.
That's very true. I mean, whenever you get, I mean, I've been, you know, my journalism career, I've met a few, and this is where everyone rolls their eyes and name drop. But when when you meet, I mean, someone like Rowan Atkinson is a really good example of someone who is an incredible performer, but the most introverted, almost monosyllabic person to speak to. Who really, even though he's very, very erudite, when you finally get him moving, to actually get him over that hump of wishing to talk to you.
Right.
And I'm talking about this in a motor racing context, because he owns loads and loads of fabulous vintage racing cars and goes around the world, you know, demonstrating them. But you try and grab him in a paddock to talk to him, it's, you know, you get, you know, absolutely nothing.
Well, I mean, I suppose if you're acting the part of somebody else, you can pretend it's nothing to do with you, whereas you don't want to reveal too much of your own personal.
Yeah. Mm. No, I think that's what it is. I mean, my middle son is deadly quiet, but he loves acting.
Does he? Right. Yeah. But he's great. I mean, acting's great. It's lucky that he's able to do it because a lot of schools don't do it anymore, do they?
Yeah, it's under tremendous pressure. Arts, I mean, you know, again, don't want to get too political, but, you know, the suggestion that you can push maths to 18 for everybody, and yet the arts wither on the vine.
Well, his school, so he's doing A-level art at the moment, and his is the last year that they're going to offer A-level art at the school and music as well. They're going to stop A-level music. It's just nuts, in my opinion. Yeah,
I mean, I was a mathematician, really. I mean, I was pushed. I wanted to do maths and history and physics, and I was just pushed to do double maths. And I did engineering at school. So I recognise the value of maths, but I also recognise the value of the arts. You know, I mean, I work in the arts now, and
you're an artist now.
Things like music and performing, acting, they're just great for your confidence and great. They give you great skills which are completely transferable. I know we do need more mathematicians, but we don't need people who aren't interested in maths being forced to do it, because they will never become your top mathematicians that we need to evolve and develop our technology. You know, what we should be doing is identifying the ones who are good at maths and who really want to do it, and giving them the opportunity to become as good as they can be. You know, they reckon that mathematicians at their peak at like 17 or 18, you know. I think it's misguided. You know, it's a good idea, but it's the wrong way of doing it.
You know, focus on maths. I mean, you know, if you want to improve the opportunities across the board, then just change the system so that, you know, it doesn't get narrowed down to three subjects necessarily. But that takes a lot of investment. Right. Well, we digress. And
we've solved the education problems.
Yeah, there you go.
The question should have been, if you were education minister, what would you do? But it wasn't.
Plenty. But my partner used to be a teacher. So.
Well, I used to be a governor, so I was a governor.
David, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you, and we really do wish you every success with the latest book and indeed all your future projects.
In the future, yes. And we'll meet you at Harrogate and Crime Fest, hopefully, this year.
Yeah, definitely. I've already booked the accommodation for Harrogate and Crime Fest, so...
So, we better get Riggle on then, hadn't we?
When you get too drunk, Rebecca, then we know somebody who can basically give you a fireman's carry home.
Well, if I get stuck up a tree.
It's not very comfortable, actually. The climber's lift is not very comfortable for the person being carried. They don't usually complain. It's been a pleasure talking to both of you. And good luck with your venture. And I'm hoping to see you either Harrogate or Bristol.
We'll see you both, probably. That would be wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Lovely to speak to David Beckler. We wish him all the best with the new book.
Absolutely. And out this week. Any future writing ventures he goes into?
Yep. Yeah, absolutely. And we will be speaking to next week.
The people from Plotter. That's about all we know at the moment.
Yes.
They're based in the US.
Yes. Well, Plotter is a software system. It's similar to Scrivener for you authors out there. But this one is slightly different. Well, quite considerably different. I'm going to be playing with it before we speak to them. Because it gives you the option to download a sort of framework for each genre and then work to that. So that is quite a useful feature, I think.
But yeah,
I'd be interested to know what other features it brings to the table.
Well, they claim, because when I was talking to them, I said, you do realise you're going to be talking to two complete pantsers in life.
Mm.
And they said, oh, well, you know, we can help you. We can even help the complete pantsers of the world.
Right. Is that something that sounds like a Smith song?
Yes.
Pantsers of the world unite. I think we've had the majority of our recent guests have been pantsers, have they not? Do you think?
I think so, yes, actually. It's interesting you say that, but you're right. I think... recently we've had a lot of pantsers, not so many plotters.
Well, maybe in future episodes we'll be balancing that particular equilibrium a little bit better. But anyway, it has been such a pleasure to speak to you. Don't forget to go to our website,
hobeck.net to see more about our authors, about our audiobooks, and to mention that, you know, one of the exciting things that happened in the last week or so is that I got an email out of the blue asking me to do some more audiobooks, which is fantastic. So I'm heading back into the Roman Empire.
You're going from transformational selling to the Roman Empire.
Yes, I'm doing something called The Transformational Seller for some clients of ours, which is a business book, as you might have gathered, and then going back into the Roman Empire. In fact, today, just now, I was driving along, dropping my son off at university, listening to one of my former performances.
You were? For any reason?
Well, just to get the voices back.
Oh.
Because I'm going back to be with Legionary Parvo, or Optio Parvo, as he's been promoted by the time I finished the last book, and Quadratus, and a few of the others.
How about... Yes.
Gallus.
Gallus. I had a complete mental blank then, yeah.
Yeah, and I've got to get all my accents back.
You do. I'm looking forward to it because you tend to bring your accents to your daily life.
I do. I'll sound like Gallus demanding, come on, men. You know what sort of thing.
Come on, wife. Well, I'm not your wife yet. But...
No, nor shall you be.
You heard it here first.
Well, the legionary books, Parvo's love life is always torn asunder by murderous plotters. So really looking forward to doing those again. But it was a lovely offer from W.F. Howes, the biggest audiobook producer in the country.
It'll keep him busy for a couple of months.
Well, until Ronnie O'Sullivan's book comes out, probably. If I'm honest, it's going to be quite a challenge. But looking forward to that. And, of course, as we mentioned earlier, Jonathan Peace's Cut and Shut is the first Hobeck new book of 2023, available from our website, available from Amazon, and can't recommend it highly enough. If you haven't read the previous two, please go and seek those out.
Yeah, and pre-order. I mean, it's only a day, but,
That's Dirty Little Secret and From Sorrow's Hold. And, of course, we have many, many other wonderful crime, thriller, mystery and suspense books for your perusal and for your enjoyment here at Hobeck Books. But for myself, Adrian Hobart.
And myself, Rebecca Collins.
Thank you so much for joining us. And all it remains for us to say is, of course, have a wonderful and...
snowy.
And creative week. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Hobcast from Hobeck Books with Adrian Hobart and Rebecca Collins. You can find the show notes at our website, www.hobeck.net. You can also use the exclusive Hobcast discount code for any of the products at our Hobeck online store. Just enter the code HOBCAST20 for a 20% discount. Don't forget to subscribe to the Hobcast and feel free to contact us with any feedback. Until next time, remember our motto, Trad Values, Indie Spirit.